From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hours before U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's scheduled visit to the Saudi capital of Riyadh, at least 9 suicide bombers attacked a foreign housing compound in the city last night, killing 20 or more people and injuring nearly 200 others. At least 7 Americans were among the dead. Powell said the attacks had the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda. Swift and fierce condemnations of the bombing came from American and Saudi officials. An investigation is underway. President Bush has promised American justice, which must be daunting when the Mideast looks at the smoldering rubble of Baghdad. But the trouble in Saudi Arabia is bigger than one bombing, and bigger even than Al-Qaeda. An old Washington-Riyadh alliance built on oil may be crumbling alongside a teetering House of Saud. Tonight, On Point, terror in Riyadh and big trouble brewing in Saudi Arabia. We begin in the Saudi capital, where Stephen Wiseman, chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, is covering the suicide bombing and Secretary of State Colin Powell's visit. Earlier, I asked him to share the latest information on the attacks.
The attacks were amazingly similar in each of 3 residential compounds here in Riyadh in the Saudi capital. And it's really kind of weird to see these compounds. They're walled off areas, of course. They have guards at the front. And the attackers, all within a few minutes of each other, even though the compounds are miles apart, broke through the front gate by managing to shoot the sentries or the guards at the gate and then send another truck into the center of the compound where it, in at least 2 cases, drove a rather circuitous route to the center and then blew up, tearing off the fronts of apartment buildings and villas and just creating rubble and a stench of explosives with furniture and clothing strewn about.
Very powerful bombs from all the images that we've seen. We read there are some 40,000 Americans living in Saudi Arabia, about 12,000 of them in Riyadh. And in these compounds, they can live a kind of American-style life. Liquor is available. They can mix men and women around the swimming pool.
They're not garish or obvious. In fact, they're rather drab with brown walls and very squat-looking. But they obviously are a source of resentment.
Steve, we read in one of your stories with Neil McFarquhar that some of the attackers shot their way into and out of at least some of the compounds. So not all of the actors involved with these attacks were suicide bombers.
The evidence so far is that they shot their way into, but not necessarily out of the compounds. But there is some evidence, according to the American officials I talked to, that they shot their way in and then fled either from the gate after opening it because they operated in teams or maybe even before the bomb went off inside.
How are U.S. officials responding to the attacks?
Colin Powell has left, but by coincidence he came here for a meeting with the royal family and the leaders of Saudi Arabia to promote the Middle East peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. And last night he was in Amman when he heard around midnight that these blasts had occurred. His advisors say that he never gave any thought to changing his trip, so he came here. Of course he scrapped his plans, and instead of meeting with Saudi citizens and others, He went to the site and got briefings on what happened. And I must tell you that the scene of him at this bombed-out apartment structure, I guess some of it may have been on American television, was amazingly eerie. The first was the heat. It was more than 100 degrees. And then there was the stench. And then, just as he was winding up the visit, came a horrific sandstorm of the kind that you saw during the Gulf War.
What a picture.
The air turned completely brown and flotsam and jetsam was flying around. I really thought to myself, this must be what hell is like. And, of course, the secretary looked like, to me, a defeated or dejected man, as anybody would be, even though he showed a lot of resolve and said, we're going to fight terrorism.
Dejected because of the scene of death and loss and attack right there.
Just a sickening scene.
Steve Wiseman, Colin Powell said today this was a well-planned terrorist attack. It has all the fingerprints of an Al-Qaeda operation. President Bush said the United States will find the killers and they will learn the meaning of American justice. What are American officials saying off the record? How are they interpreting this very well-coordinated and very deadly attack in the capital of an ally, Saudi Arabia?
Well, the fact that these groups are operating in Saudi Arabia has been a source of great contentiousness between America and the Saudis since 9/11, and this doesn't help matters. Both the Americans and the Saudis were saying today that we've really turned a corner on terrorism. We've actually subdued the groups. We've broken up al-Qaeda, but that doesn't mean that they've been wiped out entirely, and that's what people are saying in private.
Speak to us, Stephen Weissman, about Saudi response to the degree that you've been able to hear and see it today.
This is devastating for the Saudis. You could see it in their faces. It's an embarrassment. The Saudis are vexed over this. They feel that they've made considerable progress in both cracking down on al-Qaeda. Only last week, the Saudi police announced that they had found a cache of arms and explosives, that they were hunting for 19 suspected militants.
But at the same time, there was the report that the attempt to catch those 19 was botched. They got away.
Yes, but their view is that they're at least trying. Of course, another development that's happening is that the United States has made a tacit decision to withdraw its forces, many of its forces, from Saudi Arabia in hopes that that will remove an irritant.
And do you sense, Stephen Weissman, that this kind of incident pulls Washington and Riyadh closer together, or does it drive a wedge between these two governments?
That's a tough question. You know, I hate to sound cute, but I think the answer to that is both. This is a rough period that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are going through. But the context of this is something that we haven't mentioned yet, which is the highest priority that the United States has now in the Middle East. It has two high priorities. One is to establish a credible government in Iraq, and the other is to get a Middle East peace process going that the Arabs regard as credible, and concessions by Israel to get that going. And the United States is working hard on both those things. There are tremendous setbacks. This has not been a good week for at least the Middle East peace process. But I think the American view is that progress on those two fronts will improve relations with the Saudis.
Stephen Weissman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with me earlier from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. For 21 years, Robert Baer was deep in the CIA's Directorate for Operations in the Middle East. He's now out of the CIA and raising a very public alarm. In the June issue of the Atlantic Monthly, in an article entitled The Fall of the House of Saud, Baer writes that today's Saudi Arabia is a breathtakingly irrational state run by a dysfunctional royal family and riding a tiger of angry Islamic fundamentalism. I asked him earlier to give some context for the bombing in Riyadh.
I think we're going to face some real problems in Saudi Arabia. I interpret the withdrawal of our troops as a one-sided thing, and I think the Saudis wanted them gone. I think their presence there was causing a lot of problems for the royal family. I think this was conveyed to Washington. The first Gulf War was very unpopular among the Saudi people. The second war against Iraq was certainly unpopular, and I think we're seeing manifestations of this. Saudi Arabia is the most Islamic country in the Middle East. These people are believers, and they simply don't want us there.
And when you say the withdrawal of U.S. troops, which has been announced and in some small degree has already begun, was one-sided, what do you mean by that? What would another side have been?
The way it's been described by the administration, it was a common decision to withdraw the troops. We didn't need them because Saddam is gone. We could use Doha or Qatar. It served everybody's purposes. They were expensive and so forth. I think that's a spin on what really happened. The Saudis have wanted those troops gone for a long time. Bin Laden certainly did. I think at some point the Saudi people wanted them gone. And I think now the royal family does.
So, Robert Baer, you were there looking on as a senior CIA official for a long time. Is it appropriate for the United States to be looking at Saudi Arabia as an ally? It is certainly a major, very major supplier of oil. Is it an ally in the full sense of the word?
No, I don't think it is. It's an ally in that it's been our banker of oil. It withholds 2 to 3 million barrels of oil off the market, which is very expensive for Saudi Arabia.
Withholds in order to have excess supply that it can pour into the system as required?
Exactly. If there's a strike in Venezuela, for instance, or a disruption in Nigeria, mm-hmm. The Saudis pump more oil. They pumped a lot of oil during the first Gulf War when Kuwaiti and Iraqi oil were taken off the market. They kept down the price remarkably. But when it comes to strategy over in the Middle East, non-economic strategy, they're not our ally.
What about in the war on terror? We just saw Americans and others die in a bombing that looks very clearly like a terrorist strike, several bombings coordinated. Is Saudi Arabia an ally in the war on terror?
No, it's not. It's definitely not. I know I'm off message when I say that, but we've never gotten to the bottom of the first National Guard barracks bombing in 1995.
Khobar Towers.
Khobar Towers happened a year later.
I'm sorry.
1996.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, in fact, the two attacks, we've never really understood, or I've never seen published at least, either inside the CIA or out, who was behind these bombings. We have never been told how the 15 hijackers on September 11th were recruited.
The 15
of the 19 who were Saudi, I think, were recruited inside Saudi Arabia. They had some sort of mentors where they were in the mosques or the bazaar or wherever. We just have not got an answer to that. The man, the principal guy who fed the ATM machines in Dubai, has been arrested in Pakistan, but we still don't know what was his support network inside Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a state closed off to the West.
So take us inside that state, Robert Baer. If it's not, in your view, a dependable ally or a dependable ally in the war on terror, is that a kind of unanimous problem within the Saudi royal family, which runs the country, or are there elements? Pick that apart for us a bit.
This is very difficult, and I don't claim to be an authority on what goes on, you know, deep inside Saudi Arabia. You'd need a Saudi to tell you that, but they can't. But what I can tell you is that members of the security service, members of the military, are sympathetic to bin Laden.
Why? Wouldn't bin Laden tear down the very structure of the royal family of which they are great beneficiaries?
Well, there are certain members of the royal family who feel, how should I put this, disenfranchised, that they're not getting their part. And they themselves are believers who may be supportive or at least sympathetic to bin Laden. But I'm talking about the policemen on the street or in the security services who are mad at the royal family. They think they've lost their legitimacy and would support a group that launched this attack on Riyadh. I think there's good indication these people exist.
And what would their goal be? What outcome would they hope for from this and potentially other terrorist attacks in the future? To what end?
Well, I mean, they believe in an Islamic utopia. And if Saudi Arabia can expel the West and Western influence, whether it's McDonald's or the United States Air Force or our embassy or whatever, they think they will have a more pure society and they will carry on with God's word and create a utopia.
What's the answer for the United States looking forward?
I think the United States should worry about our oil supplies very pragmatically. You know, there's a humanitarian issue, but I think that if Saudi Arabia is heading toward a situation like we saw in Iran in 1979, we should figure out how to secure those oil supplies.
You mean securing oil supplies inside Saudi Arabia, putting garrisons around those oil fields or something?
It might be necessary. Because remember, if Saudi Arabia, this is the worst case scenario, goes under, it's going to take a lot of other countries with it.
Why?
You can't contain it because there's Wahhabis in Qatar. There's tribal groups.
So you mean in terms of Islamic countries, but also there would be a huge tsunami effect in terms of oil if that oil supply were disrupted?
I think so. Remember that five very dysfunctional families own 60% of the world's oil reserves.
That's a breathtaking figure. Where does that leave us? Are you saying the United States should begin to move militarily in Saudi Arabia, or are there diplomatic moves that would suffice?
I think diplomatic moves would. We're going to have to come to a frank discussion with the Saudis about what's happening inside their country, you know, what we can do to help to stabilize the place. I mean, you can go around and bash Saudis all you want, say if we got rid of this royal family, that, you know, we can hold elections and things will be well. And it's not going to work that way. We're going to have an Iran situation when Khomeini tried to impose Islamic law in Iran. We don't want that. We want there's got to be some pragmatic diplomatic political solution.
We'll hope.
But failing that, then you have to look at a military one.
Well, Robert Baer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Baer is a former CIA official and author of the forthcoming book, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Its Soul for Saudi Crude. We're talking tonight about a bombing in Riyadh and big trouble brewing in Saudi Arabia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a bombing in Riyadh and big trouble brewing in Saudi Arabia. You can join the conversation. What is your interpretation of the Riyadh bombing? What does it mean? Is Saudi Arabia the easy whipping boy of the hour, or do we have a problem here? How do you defuse a nation ruled by corrupt royals sitting on top of a fundamentalist powder keg? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Washington, D.C. by John Esposito. He's University Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University, author of more than a dozen books on Islam, including Unholy War, Terror in the Name of Islam, and What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam. Good evening and welcome, John Esposito.
Thank you.
John, lots of hand-wringing today, mourning for lives lost in Riyadh, and lots of speculation about the source both of this attack and the wider context of Saudi Arabia, and whether we've got, in the wake of war in Iraq and 9/11 and everything else, whether we've got a combination of elements that is stable in this country, stable internally and stable as an American ally. How do you look out on this bombing and the country in which it happened?
Well, I think that, you know, realistically, one has to look at the fact that the House of Saud has had problems since the late 1970s in terms of sort of, in a sense, uprisings or public criticism of the kingdom. 9/11 alerted many to the internal domestic problems that it had in terms of Osama and many of the Saudis who were involved in 9/11. Post 9/11, as far as we can see, in many ways, the Saudi government under Abdullah has tried to address both its external and its internal critics. Maybe not as much as some would like, but I think there's been an attempt to address that. I think that the recent bombings, you know, are a clear indication that either al-Qaeda exists within Saudi Arabia or certainly al-Qaeda-like groups, and that they want to send a double message. One is to the United States, Powell being in the area, and basically indicating that it's not just enough that Americans are pulling their troops out, they want all Americans out. And on the other hand, trying to send a message within the kingdom that the kingdom is vulnerable and that, in fact, there is militant dissent within the kingdom.
But where are we headed here? If Washington was ready to make a case that that Saddam Hussein supported international terrorism on what, by most accounts, was fairly slim evidence, the evidence of financial support from Saudi Arabia for al-Qaeda seems substantially greater. Do you see threads between the kind of heart of power in the kingdom and these expressions of terrorism, these attacks?
I think that there is no doubt that in the past, there have been a variety of independent supporters within the Gulf of extremist groups, that is, very wealthy businessmen, etc. How much that actually gets into government officials has not been at all demonstrated.
But the government and the royal family are kind of intertwined and at this point very large and sprawling, are they not?
They are, but I think that it would be very premature to jump the gun and say that the royal family, in any sense, as a royal family, is supportive of al-Qaeda or extremists, because, in fact, that's saying that the royal family has a death wish.
Well, some make the case that it's already got itself in an almost inescapable situation here, where it relies domestically on the ultra-Orthodox Wahhabi sect of Islam that has traditionally supported the House of Saud, and which is very it's anti-Western at base, and at the same time, its chief customers are Westerners. Its chief ally is the United States. Is that a sustainable combination?
Well, I think that one of the problems that, in fact, the Saudi regime has had, and I mean this runs long before 9/11, is that there has been this kind of relationship between the House of Saud and the more conservative, Wahhabi leadership, which helps to establish religious legitimacy at the same time as it has pursued a close relationship with the United States. But I think it's important to note that that position has become more and more ambivalent. For more than a decade, at a variety of points, the royal family has come down on the more militant, voices within Saudi Arabia. That is, what I mean by militant here are the violent extremist groups. But I think that where the government still has a problem is the extent to which it has to deal with the ultra-conservative voices within the kingdom itself. I think that Abdullah has tried to use his own kind of legitimacy with that group to try to move the kingdom forward. But the question is whether or not it's too late, whether or not there's enough time to try to bring about any kind of feasible reform.
That seems like a pretty large question, given the level of vitriol and heat that we hear or read reported is still coming out of the mosques in Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, you've got an envelope of very practical problems. Here I see per capita income. This figure astonished me. Per capita income in Saudi Arabia has fallen from $28,600 in 1981 to $6,800 in 2001. A tremendous drop in per capita income, country's birth rate soaring, police force reported corrupt, rule of law a sham, and then you've got this enormous royal family, 30,000 members now, estimated to be maybe 60,000 in another generation, that all presume that they will be supported in a fairly grand style by the state that just can't afford it anymore. I hear you saying, John Esposito, that its track record of surviving tough times in the past should lead us to think that it can continue to, but it looks like an awfully volatile combination of factors to my eye.
No, I think that if that's what you're hearing me wrong, or at least that I'm expressing myself incorrectly. I think that the reality of it is that Saudi Arabia, for certainly a couple of decades, certainly post Iran-Iraq war and definitely post-Gulf War, and with the enormous economic cost that the Gulf War brought, is between the House of Saud, between a rock and a hard place. A good deal of the kind of, if you will, legitimacy and support that one could buy with having the funds to provide all kinds of social services and economic services and medical services increasingly has dried up. And I think that that is an enormous challenge to the House of Saud. But I think the challenge that the United States has from a pragmatic national interest point of view is it has an established relationship in Saudi Arabia. It wants to, according to the Bush administration, see significant reforms in terms of moving towards broader political participation, limiting or eliminating the kinds of conditions that promote extremism. Well, how does the United States do that? Does the United States opt simply for regime change? If it pushes regime change, what may come after? And so in an ironic kind of way, both the House of Saud is between a rock and a hard place, but I think so is the administration.
It looks to me in a gigantic way, given American and global dependence on that oil, and it's very hard to see any kind of clean scenario that would follow a real radical solution here, and yet people are talking about radical ideas. John Esposito, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Jerusalem, Dory Gold. He's a consultant to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and was a foreign policy aide to former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations and author of a new book, Hatred's Kingdom, How Saudi Arabia Supports the New Global Terrorism. Good evening and welcome, Dory Gold.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Dory Gold, you've written a very tough book on Saudi Arabia here, drawing the line for the kind of ideology behind terrorism back to the Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia. When you look out at the attack that we saw last night, bombings at three separate compounds and 20-plus dead, nearly 200 wounded, how do you understand the context of Saudi Arabian politics and life that surrounds those incidents? Dory Gold.
I think it's too early to give an assessment about whether the Saudi government has any relationship to what specifically occurred. What we have is basically a whole decade of Saudi patterns that are important to watch. Number one, there are three large Saudi official charities, official in the sense that the Saudi government contributes to them. There's the Al-Haramain Organization, the International Islamic Relief Organization, and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. And all three have been connected with terrorist financing. In Hatred's Kingdom, my book, I actually have captured Saudi documents that were found in Palestinian headquarters that show the pattern of Saudi financing of Hamas through organizations of this sort. We have canceled checks, a payment schedule of the IIRO, and we have also information about a recent Hamas high-level delegation visit under the auspices of Crown Prince Abdullah as late as October 2002.
So unlike John Esposito, you're not hanging back from drawing a connection, a financial connection, between kind of the power centers of Saudi Arabia and support for funds that you say have ended up in the pockets of terrorists. Is that right?
Hello? Pardon, are you addressing me? Or
yes, I am. I'm putting that to you, Dory Gold. You're saying, John Esposito said earlier, we don't see a connection between the official sort of centers of power in Saudi Arabia and terrorism. You're saying, yes, we do.
Well, I think we do. And the main thing is that these charities are not just some NGOs or they don't belong to some kind of lunatic fringe. For example, the IIRO that I mentioned, which can be documented as having supported Hamas and has been involved with Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines and other groups in East Africa and the Balkans, their representative in Canada testified in a Canadian court last year and admitted that his organization, IIRO, is a fully government-funded organization. And I'm now quoting him. He said, in other words, I work for the government of Saudi Arabia. So these charities are not separate from the government of Saudi Arabia, and with ministers like the Minister of Islamic Affairs taking a leading role in El Haramain, or with Saudi high-level princes donating on television and other public events money to organizations like IIRO, there's a direct connection between leading government officials in the Saudi government, these large international Islamic charities, and their support for terrorist groups around the world.
Dory Gold, assuming for a moment that that's the case, what can be done about it?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to work with the Saudi government and to try and make it clear to them that the West has this evidence.
So you're saying no regime change?
I'm not advocating regime change. I think you have to work with them. I think there are forces in Saudi Arabia that know this, object to it, and are looking for a lead from the West to object to this kind of activity. I think it's very important to, for example, in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian roadmap that Secretary Powell has been trying to advance, to work with the first phase of the roadmap, which specifically says that Arab states must cut off public and private funding and all other forms of support for groups supporting and engaging in violence and terrorism.
But what about the dilemma that John Esposito described, and it's not hard to see, you know it well yourself, that this is a royal family that has for decades, for centuries, depended on the support of the Wahhabi sect of Islam, which is very tough-minded. How can they move away from that traditional power base and stay in power and at the same time open things up to perhaps something like elements of democracy? Can this be pulled off, or do we have a train wreck in the making here?
The critical question is if the future Saudi princes can legitimize their rule in other ways other than just depending on the support of the Wahhabi clerics. Because the Wahhabi clerics, as you hinted, have identified with elements of the global jihad that's advocated by al-Qaeda. Legitimizing government rule usually is through democracy, is through more inclusive instruments of government. But I think we can't wait for that. I think there has to be immediate action. Saudi Arabian security forces have to really dismantle the vast infrastructure of al-Qaeda that's located both in the southern part of the Saudi kingdom and in the northern areas. I think they have to move quickly. And that last move that the New York Times reporter described earlier, in which they found a large cache of weapons, they clearly failed to nab the operatives of al-Qaeda, the 19 who they were looking for.
Right.
They need to grab both personnel and weapons, establish how the funding mechanisms work, and break them. If they do that, Saudi Arabia will be more secure, the U.S. will be more secure, and it'll be possible even to establish an Arab-Israeli peace process.
John Esposito, do you see the possibility of the Saudi royal family under Crown Prince Abdullah, of course the king is incapacitated after a stroke some years ago, do you see it as possible that he might introduce enough democracy and reform into this equation that, as Dory Gold suggests, the royal family might move away from its dependence for legitimacy on Islamic hardliners?
I think Dory Gold's suggestion is an important one. Whether or not that can be done, it certainly in recent months has looked as if the Crown Prince has wanted to talk about more accountability. He's denounced corruption. He's talked about extending, as it were, broadening political participation. But one has to keep in mind the fact that, as we were talking about earlier, the royal family is a very large royal family, and although the crown prince is the crown prince, there are sort of other contending forces within the royal family. One of the points that I think I'd like to make here, though, is that one also has to distinguish with regard to these organizations like the World Assembly of Muslim Youth and others, and support for different groups, between what is the official position of the government and what are specific members of the royal family doing. Because, as you've noted before, when you talk about the royal family, you're talking about thousands of people who belong to the royal family. And I think, you know, that complicates things more. I think that one of the points that, both you and Dory Gold made, which are really important, is to what extent can the royal family assert its leadership and establish a certain kind of direction and control that, while it may certainly accommodate religious forces within the kingdom, be able to also control and distance itself from the militant voices within the kingdom that are part of the problem and not the solution.
Not an easy thing to do. I want to turn to our callers. Josh is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is a great topic and a very important one. And I also think Dory Gold is right on track. I think we as Americans are making a mistake just because we say the Saudis are our allies. That doesn't make it so. And if you look at what they do, they're really not allies. I mean, I think they sponsor terrorism. I think if we look at it, they sponsor terrorism. I find it repugnant that the Saudi government is giving money to Hamas, to other terrorists. The mullahs are sponsoring terrorism. And you can't have terrorist operations exist without the funding and without the resources that they're providing in Saudi Arabia.
But, Josh, what about Saudi Arabia's cooperation with the United States for many, many years on the oil front, keeping that big capacity to open up the pipelines and put more oil in the system when necessary? They did it during the war with Iraq. They've done it many times before. That's a kind of fundamental alliance, isn't it, around oil and economics?
I see what you mean, but I think the Saudis think about the Saudis. They release the pumps when they want more oil revenue. They'll cheat the quotas on OPEC when they want to get more revenues. And I think they pretend to crack down on terrorism when the U.S. puts pressure on, but when they're feeling pressure from the Islamist extremists, they'll say, the U.S. is your enemy. Go after McDonald's. Go after these Western influences.
Yep. Josh, you've got it. Let me put that to Dory Gold. Dory Gold, where do you see the pressure points here? I mean, the Saudi royal family must feel the pressure, but to really push them toward action or encourage action, what's the best way? Where's the leverage?
Well, first of all, the United States, despite its pulling out of Saudi Arabia, still is the country that ultimately offers Saudi Arabia protection. And the United States has to become perhaps more active in the clandestine area, working with intelligence agencies to do something about the Saudi failure to crack down on Al-Qaeda. I mean, it is clear that Saudi Arabia is one of the areas where Al-Qaeda has sought refuge since the American victory in Afghanistan. The other two places are the Iraq-Iran border and the Pakistani-Afghani border. It's time the Saudis take this seriously. The Saudi modus operandi that they can pay protection money to Al-Qaeda and keep Al-Qaeda from attacking Saudi citizens just is no longer plausible, because it leads to more attacks on Western targets.
Dory Gold, please stand by. And John Esposito, listeners, we are talking tonight about a bombing in Riyadh and big trouble brewing in Saudi Arabia. Will we make it through the next decade without U.S. troops sitting at Saudi oil fields? Doesn't the Saudi royal family itself have an interest in containing Al-Qaeda? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ghost. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a bombing in Riyadh and big trouble brewing in Saudi Arabia. My guests tonight are John Esposito, University Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University, author of Unholy War, Terror in the Name of Islam, and Dory Gold, joining us from Jerusalem. He is former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations and author of the new book, Hatred's Kingdom, How Saudi Arabia Supports the New Global Terrorism. You can join the conversation as well. Will we make it through the next decade without U.S. troops sitting at Saudi oil fields? Don't Saudi Arabia's decades as a remarkably steady supplier of oil for the U.S. still count for something here? And how deep could the U.S. ever really, realistically, conceivably intervene in the land of Mecca and Medina? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Simple question and possibly a very complex answer. Do we need their oil more than they need our money? envision of a utopia, of an Islamic utopia without the United States in it, where perhaps bin Laden, some radicalized faction of the royal family, whomever, cuts off the American oil supply to shell us or to get even with us or to punish us. I hope they realize that as soon as they cut off the oil supply, we'll stop writing them checks. And what's that effect going to be on the Saudi economy, turmoil or not?
Got it, got it. Good question, Andrew. Thanks for calling in with it. John Esposito, take us a little bit into the economics here. I mean, as I understand it, and reading what Robert Baer is writing, the United States cannot do, the world cannot do without Saudi oil, but there is talk of some elements within Saudi Arabia being so committed to what our caller describes as a kind of new Islamic utopia that they would consider shutting down the pumps for a while. Can you imagine a kind of fundamental divergence of interest over oil or willing to part ways? Is it possible?
Well, I think in terms of our need for Saudi oil, the fact is people have been saying for more than a decade that the U.S. could move itself to a position of being more independent from not just Saudi oil, but in a sense oil from the Gulf. But that would mean that we would have to make a lot of hard decisions at home, which no administration has been willing to do.
So the evidence is that we perhaps can't do it as a people. We don't have the where, we don't have the what it takes to
the administration
to do it.
No administration has had the guts to bite the bullet.
All right.
I think that where I would differ a little with what your caller is saying is that the issue in terms of Saudi Arabia is not so much our giving them money, although, you know, clearly it's the money for oil, but it's also the role that we've played in a significant way has been as a military presence. The other point I'd want to make here is that where I differ a little bit with what Dory Gull said earlier is that I think the real judgment with regard to Saudi Arabia and its handling of the situation is, are we talking about an ineffective response or even an ineffective or incompetent response rather than saying that the government is paying protection money to al-Qaeda? As far as I can see, there's no evidence of that.
Dory Gold, how about that? Is this a kind of malicious support, deliberate knowing for a terrorist threat to the West and to themselves, I would say, or is it something less deliberate than that?
Well, I don't think it really matters because the net result is the same. You have al-Qaeda growing in power and able to operate from Saudi Arabia as well as from other places in the world. We spoke about these large Muslim charities, the International Islamic Relief Organization. These aren't supported by peripheral princes who have gone bad. These are supported by people like Prince Sultan or Prince Nayef, and it's in fact documented in official Saudi journals like Ain al Yaqeen. So we know that the leading members of the royal family have been backing these charities, and we know that these charities have been funneling money to al-Qaeda.
But the issue of intent does seem important in this way. I mean, you yourself are saying you're not calling for regime change here. We're talking about can the United States, that is, work with the Saudi royal family toward reform and change? But if within that family there's a significant element that is committed to a more radical, militant, violent approach, that would seem to be a difficult partner, Dory Gold.
I think some do identify with sort of the bin Laden approach to the world, but I think others oppose him. But I do believe they have been paying protection money, and that's not just my assessment. That's an assessment that's come from leading people in the U.S. Department of State and other intelligence services on the record who have analyzed this issue, including Robert Baer, by the way, who
our guest tonight earlier.
Show.
Jay's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. Great show as usual.
Yes.
I want to put into proper historical context the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
All right.
When oil was first discovered in Saudi Arabia, the pact that was made between the U.S. and the House of Saud was that the House of Saud would ensure a steady supply of oil in return for total freedom as to what they did inside their own society. And that has resulted over the years in tremendous human rights abuses, the lack of a civil society, no democracy, and we have turned a blind eye.
So you're saying the United States should have been speaking up more over many years? Is that your point, Jay?
That was the root. That was the basis of the relationship we had with them. But we have used them. Now, during the Afghanistan crisis, we used the Saudi Arabian money to fund bin Laden. The CIA did that and so on, unleashed kind of militarized a section of the society that was disgruntled. And now, within that same society, there is no freedom, there is no room for moderation, and now these extremist forces are threatening the very house of Saud.
That is clear. Jay, thank you for your call. John Esposito, what about it? Is the United States reaping the whirlwind of decades of not giving a darn?
I don't quite think that that's the case. I think that, you know, one of the things we have to realize, we demand this of ourselves, and the Israelis would demand this of themselves and any country.
Demand what?
That is that countries have a right to pursue their own national interests. We struck a bargain. I mean, as the United States strikes a bargain with many countries in terms of its national interests, we did it during the Cold War, we do it today. And the bargain and the trade-off is, you know, what do you have that we need, and in exchange for that, you know, we give X, but it doesn't mean that we say, okay, we have a bargain where we get your oil, but we're also going to, in a sense, demand that we have a right to tell you everything that you ought to do within your country.
Mm-hmm.
And let me be very clear on something
here. All right.
I've written for many years about the fact that the issue of political participation and democratization is a major issue throughout the Arab and Muslim world. So I'm not at all trying to defend the right of regimes to be anti-human rights or anti-political participation. But I'm saying if you look at the way in which the United States has functioned in terms of its foreign policy and the way in which many nations do, you know, we in effect operate in terms of our national interest, and we strike bargains with other governments, many of whose governments we may not be particularly crazy about, but it serves our national interest.
John Esposito, I wonder if that's not changing now. The Bush administration has a doctrine of preemptive war. President Bush today, after, of course, earlier having said you're either with us or against us in the war on terrorism, he said today that he has no doubt that the perpetrators of this bombing in Riyadh will come to learn the meaning of American justice. Now, in the case of Iraq, that meant Saddam Hussein was out, that a huge American force went in. Is there now, in fact or perceived, a threat of American military intervention, even in Saudi Arabia? Robert Baer was saying earlier, at some point, if things get too wild and out of hand, the U.S. has no strategic choice but to go in with a military presence and sit around those oil facilities. What's your view, John Esposito?
I don't think that the Bush administration will want to at all attempt to communicate that at this point. I think that what the Bush administration is saying, what President Bush is saying, is that, you know, America will not stand for this, and I think any president would say it. And I think the next move will be that the American administration will, in effect, say to the Saudi government, we have to do something about this. I don't think that the American administration at this point in time will want to at all be sending a message that, you know, that we're going to come into your country, because I think that one has to recognize that whatever has been the past in terms of the Saudi government, no one can stop the kind of attack that took place. One can attempt to contain it. We know in America that we could be subject to such an attack. And I don't think that Bush at this point is trying to say we will simply announce at any point that we're going to go into any country. I think he's going to want to portray this as we're going to work with our ally, and that's a great way of putting pressure on the Saudi government to work with us to capture and bring these people to justice.
Boy, but I have to say that I read reports in the region that there's a lot of sensitivity there about who's next, and no one feels entirely invulnerable. Sam's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great program. I'm a usual listener, and I would like to commend you for your presentation.
Thanks, Sam. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, basically, I would like to say a small comment. The Saudi government has been the staunchest enemy of Arab democratization throughout its inception.
Mm-hmm.
They fought Arab nationalism. They fought moderate Islamic movements and replaced it with sort of this medieval version of Islam. I'm very happy to see them crumble as they are now, but I am not happy with our perception of the whole problem of our national interests through the interests of Israel.
Give us that point quick. What do you mean, Sam?
Basically, if you look at the whole Middle East policy since Clinton and before, and I don't know, from the Nixon administration onward, you see a shift in U.S. policy with the growth, corresponding with the growth of the Israeli lobby in this country, where they've hijacked the policy of foreign policy of the U.S. vis-a-vis Israel in the Middle East.
So how would that change our relationship with Saudi Arabia today? I mean, even if we didn't have that relationship with Israel, you'd still have the House of Saud, and would you not still have the kind of Wahhabi hardliners?
Well, basically, if we promote democracy, demanding the Saudi government open up and reform, supporting King Abdullah's council, family council, or whatever steps he takes,
okay.
or even asking for open democracy,
yeah.
but not to forget that this might lead to moderate Islamists, which will not accept Israeli transgressions against the Palestinians. We're trying to do to get like sort of an Ahmad Chalabi type. You see, it's hard. You cannot expect democracy in the Middle East and acceptance of Israeli aggression and occupation.
Sam, you raise a great big point. I want to put it straight to Dory Gold. Dory Gold, you of course are right in the have been and right in the middle of all this. Consultant to Ariel Sharon, aide to former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? How much of the tension inside Saudi Arabia, the anger and bitterness inside Saudi Arabia, in your mind, as a prominent Israeli, can be chalked up to the conflict to which you are party?
Well, if you analyze very carefully what's being said in the Saudi mosques, and in Hatred's Kingdom, I actually downloaded from the web in Arabic mosque sermons, a whole cross-section from Taif, from Dammam, from Riyadh, from Mecca, Medina, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
What you see is that the fundamental hatred in Saudi Arabia is directed against the West. It's directed against the Sulubiyya, which is the crusaderism of the West, and it's anti-Christian, it's against the Pope. It's far more fundamental than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the short-term changes there. You know, the whole growth of al-Qaeda in the 90s occurred while the Arab-Israeli peace process was thriving under the Oslo agreements. So the connection between the two is really tenuous.
John Esposito,
let me just finish my point. The way to move forward, though, and really change the situation on the ground, we've got to get to a situation where the Palestinians take responsibility for security in their own cities and Israel can pull back its forces.
We understand that point. I want to get one more call here. Mudafa is calling from Dorchester. Hi, Mudafa. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing, sir?
Fine, thanks. Make it quick. Our time is short.
I agree with the previous caller, but I also want to state that terrorism is a reflection of a desperation overwhelmed the whole region. I mean, even in Palestine or in Iraq or in Saudi Arabia.
And desperation in Saudi Arabia or Islamic fundamentalism and intolerance? Which, Mudafa?
Islamic fundamentalism, it's when you go extreme in religion, it's sometimes it's a reflection of a desperate reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessary to represent the view of Islam itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly why people sometimes they go more than what they're supposed to be and more than what's normal to interpret religion the way they want.
Like, Mudafa, I'm sorry, that's all I have time for tonight. John Esposito, I want to turn to you here, please.
Yeah, anti-Americanism is widespread in the Arab and Muslim world, and it's due to two major things.
Yes.
Number one, American support in the past for authoritarian regimes. And number two, what many Arabs and Muslims see as an imbalance in America's approach towards the Arab-Israeli question. And we cannot deny that. There are enough studies both before 9/11, post-9/11, and post-Iraq war. We need, as an American country, to deal with that. And I think the Secretary of State is very much aware of that. So it's a two-pronged problem. Our past support for authoritarian regimes in the region, uncritical support, as well as what many in the region see as an imbalance in our support. We need to move against Palestinian terrorism. We also need to move against the violence and terror that has been at times engaged in by Israeli forces in Palestinian areas.
And with that, we are out of time. John Esposito, I want to thank you for joining us from Washington tonight. John Esposito is University of Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University, author of What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam, and Dory Gold in Jerusalem, staying up late for us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
Dory Gold is former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations and author of the new book, Hatred's Kingdom, How Saudi Arabia Supports the New Global Terrorism. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded